WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dragoo, and today is May 29th, Memorial Day. Memorial Day is for honoring and mourning those who died while serving in the United States Armed Forces. And here at The New American and our parent company, the John Birch Society, we honor every single person who's died for his country, despite what we believe and think of people who've sent precious American lives into conflicts we shouldn't have. For this episode, we're going to do something a little bit different. I'm joined by three employees of The New American and our parent organization, the John Birch Society, who are military veterans. And we'll be discussing whether you can be anti-war and still support the troops. I'm going to let the gentlemen introduce themselves and then we'll get started. So gentlemen, go ahead and introduce yourselves and then we'll start talking.
Well, I'm Drew Dorans. I was in the Army from 2006 to 2014 as a wheeled mechanic.
I'm Art Thompson. I was in the Army and National Guard for 6 years in the 1960s.
I'm Joe Kelly. I was in the Army from 1991 to 1998, and I was a cavalry scout.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for your service, by the way. So, Art, we're going to start with you. You're obviously also the president emeritus of the John Birch Society. And I wanted to ask you, what does the Constitution say about war and when it's justified?
Well, it doesn't say when it's justified. It just says that the Congress shall declare war, not the president or anything else. It is the Congress that does this. And that's something that's been lost over the last many years, actually since the Second World War. Congress has not declared war since we joined the United Nations at the conclusion of the Second World War. But you know, there's something that's very interesting about the oaths that we all took. I have the form that I swore to and certified with my signature and everything else. And I'd just like to read just a little portion of it.
Please do.
Kind of set the mood here, if you will. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And then it goes on. It doesn't say I'm swearing allegiance to Congress. It doesn't say I'm swearing allegiance to the president or to the generals or the general staff or anything else. It's to the law of the land, which is the Constitution.
Right.
Now, it's interesting they tell us who our enemies are because we're going to fight them, right?
Yeah.
But they don't tell us who our domestic enemies are.
Yeah, that is interesting.
You know, they'll tell us all these foreign enemies, but never talk about the domestic ones. But one of the things that's occurred since the Second World War is that we joined the United Nations. And here's a charter of the United Nations right here. And it's very interesting if you read it, and I recommend that all the readers or viewers
listeners.
Go online and look at the Charter of the United Nations and read it and see how it hamstrings the military of the United States. Because in here it says that we're going to follow the orders of the Security Council.
Huh.
And there are seven permanent members of the Security Council. And the thing is that nobody can engage in any military activity without the approval of the Security Council, and that must include, or the majority of the Council, but that must include all seven permanent members. So if we're going to have a conflict with, say, Russia or China,
we have to consult the United Nations?
Of course. Every conflict we've been involved in since the Second World War we've been involved in through the Charter of the United Nations, through the Security Council resolutions.
Yeah.
Now,
wow.
Two of those permanent members are Russia and China. Now, doesn't it seem a little bit odd that we would allow them to have some say-so over what our military does or doesn't do?
Yeah.
And they have actually acquiesced to our combat in areas except for one place. And that was Korea. Russia walked out. Remember that? You can see that you guys aren't old enough to remember that. But I am. And Russia walked out of the Security Council. So they wouldn't have to veto it or vote it. And then we sent our troops to Korea. They wanted us in that war. and they want us in these other wars. They have say-so whether we're in them or not, yeah. And they've agreed. And then you go to things like, and by the way, let me read you just one little thing here. But no enforcement action shall be taken under regional agreements or by regional agencies without the authorization of the Security Council. Okay? This is a regional agency of this that they're talking about, NATO.
Yeah.
Now, what are we involved with now with NATO?
The Ukraine-Russia.
Ukraine-Russia. And yeah. Russia has a veto over, through the Security Council, the actions of NATO. Now, we don't control our own military anymore. That's what's going on, and the American people don't have any clue. They've got to read these two treaties and see for themselves, the NATO treaty and the Charter of the United Nations, to realize we don't control our own military anymore.
When you guys signed up, did you have any idea that this was the case?
No.
In fact, when I started here at the John Birch Society and saw some of the things that we pushed out about what the UN had done with the necklacing and the angry doctors and, you know, the books that were written, I was shocked because I had just come out of the military 2 years prior to that, and I was actively participating in what you just described, where I was training and working with other militaries, and our whole operation was set in Bosnia, and we worked with other countries, training with them, you know, and at times they were setting the objectives for what we were going to do.
You saw that?
Yeah, well, as you see it as your orders come down, you know where they're coming from, you know that our generals were collaborating with the other countries and deciding on what they were going to do. But we would see all the different militaries, and the Russians at that particular time were not a powerhouse at all. I mean, they were trading us food for belts, you know. And we interacted with all these different militaries at the time, and it was, you know, we'd just be sitting there guarding gravestones and on a peacekeeping mission. I spent almost eight full years in the military, and I spent 7 of those years training for combat. To defend the country. And when I was deployed to Bosnia, it was a peacekeeping mission. We spent 6 months training for the peacekeeping mission, which is completely different than anything we've ever been trained for.
Yeah.
Because you're not shooting center mass to win a battle. You're doing police duties and things for another country.
Yeah.
As they're blowing each other's houses up.
Yeah. I noticed NATO being involved in my military career when I was in Afghanistan, because all our orders had the NATO seal on it. And when you're done with your Afghanistan deployment, you get a NATO ribbon. You get a NATO award for being there.
Yeah.
And a UN award, too. So, it's kind of the same thing as Joe's experience with multiple different militaries. And you could be assigned to a post. Like, I was doing guard duty for actually our own division headquarters, and the sergeant of arms in charge of that was actually a Canadian sergeant. So it was a little weird, you know.
Yeah. Was that surprising to you at the even then?
Yes and no, but they kind of got you ready for that type of role of being subordinate to another country's rank system when you're working with them, because that's actually military tradition. You call officers of another country, sir, you know, may take some orders, but not all orders. I mean,
yeah.
You know, but when they're the sergeant of your guard, you know, you got to take their orders.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You know, it takes a lot of military bearing, and they train you that. So, it's noticeable, but not really. It's really something that you have to take a step back and realize what is actually going on, and you won't notice it until after you've been there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Art, you mentioned something very interesting, was the whole, how they, it's clear who the enemies without are.
Yes. And,
but we have it, you know, you have it in your oath, you know, foreign and domestic enemies. Now, how do you guys feel about that? Was there ever conversation about, like, do you guys ever, you know, get bored enough to be like, you know, I just swore an oath to protect us from domestic, but like, who is that? You know, did you guys ever think about that, and do you think about it now?
Well, I did.
Yeah?
I come from the Vietnam era. They were getting us ready to go. It finally ground down to where they didn't send us, but I was the company commander of a field hospital. It was my last assignment. And I knew that we were supplying both sides. Mm. Businessmen and the United States government through various means, just like trying to track what's going on with the Biden money right now.
Yeah.
It was the same way with food and money and equipment was going to the North Vietnamese at the same time that we were fighting them mm-hmm. From the United States. And so, as a matter of fact, the John Birch Society had a petition in those days where we got over 2 million signatures into Congress calling for a secession of all aid and trade with communist countries.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but it didn't happen. It slowed it down a little bit, but it didn't completely happen. Just to give you one example of these enemies domestic. At one time, I worked at Boeing. And they asked me to do a study that prompted me to ask a question as to what airline they were trying to sell these aircraft to. Because there was only one company that flew behind the Iron Curtain at that time, and that was British Overseas Airline Company. And I says, is this for BOAC? And they said, oh no, we're trying to sell quick change cargo aircraft to Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia.
Which are communist countries.
Which are communist countries. And so I said, well, what's wrong? Isn't the ammunition getting to North Vietnam quick enough? And the guy looked at me like, what do you mean? And I just told him, I says, look, if you got other work, fine, I'll do it, but I'm not working on this.
Wow. Isn't that disobeying an order?
Yeah, it is. but I took an oath relative to domestic and foreign and domestic enemies.
Yeah.
And that may not have been a domestic enemy in the true sense of the term, mm-hmm. but they were trying to help the other side.
Yeah. Did you guys have any moments like that?
I'd say when I first joined, I was 18, just out of high school. I didn't even think about this stuff. But when I was deployed to Bosnia, that's when I probably started seeing something kind of similar to what Art was describing when I'd go up to foreign militaries and they're wearing our old gear and they're driving our old equipment and our vehicle identification includes some of our old equipment. It's like, well, why do they have that? After working at the society and the New American, I know why they have it.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it at the time. And that was right at the end of my career. And I was wondering, what is going on here?
Yeah. What about you, Drew?
In my time in Iraq, and Afghanistan, we're given our older equipment to the security forces of those countries, and it didn't really, register with me at that time because, especially in Iraq, we were actually teaching people how to work on our vehicles of the Iraqi army. So, that was a little different.
But they weren't considered enemies anyway, right?
No. There was instances where they became our enemies, but for the most part, they were, all about learning from us and mm-hmm. whatnot. So they weren't viewed as enemies. So I really didn't run into anything. I mean, I was a specialist. So
you want to add something quickly?
Yeah. So I was going to interject that my experience then, you can extrapolate that out today. And if you go online, anybody watching this broadcast can go online and look up the various American companies like Boeing and General Electric and others that are working with the Chinese and the Russians, developing their aircraft industry and chemical industry and everything else. The Chinese had no capability of large frame aircraft building until we built a 737 factory there for China.
And that wouldn't have happened without help from the United States, right?
It was a totally Boeing deal.
Yeah.
In that case.
So would you consider that a case of, someone acting as a domestic enemy when they arm and they help our enemy? I mean, I don't know if China was considered an enemy now. I guess they're becoming that now. But the John Birch Society kind of always knew that that's where this was going.
Of course. I mean, it's pretty obvious. you know, but we used to study how China was even changed into a communist state. That came from the State Department.
The U.S. State Department.
The U.S. State Department.
Yeah, it's important.
Produced the communist government in China, period.
Right.
And it was a big deal back in the 50s that had happened.
Let's take a quick break, and we will be right back to finish this conversation, guys.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American magazine represents an alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. It's Memorial Day, and we are talking to members or veterans, military veterans, who are employees of the New American and or the John Birch Society. And we've been discussing the theme of anti-war is right, not left. Thank you, gentlemen. So I was on my way home the other day, and I was listening to a Merle Haggard song came on, and it's called The Fight Inside of Me. And it's a Vietnam era song. I don't know if you guys are familiar. And it was kind of like it's anti-American. You know, it was supposed to be kind of like a thumb your nose at the hippies who were supposed to against the Vietnam War. Now, this is what we really want to get down to. And you know, can you be pro-America, pro-troops, and be anti-war? Looks like you're ready to jump in, Art.
I actually have a really good parallel to this. So, yes, first of all. Secondly, you know, my father was a Vietnam veteran. So a lot of the things that he experienced when he came back from Vietnam was very nasty treatment just for being a soldier.
Yeah.
And I know that his generation wanted to make sure my generation in Iraq, Afghanistan, which was also not a popular war, wanted to make sure that we were treated better than what they were when they came home, regardless of how they feel about the war.
Right. How do we do that?
Yeah, so, you know, so that generation got it right. The baby boomer generation got it right about how you should treat soldiers regardless how you feel about the war. You know, because it's about taking care of people on a humane level, you know, while you could still disagree with the political ideology of war.
Okay. What do you think, Art?
Well, of course, you don't want to send men into combat unless there's a valid reason for that.
Yeah.
Where there's a clear and present danger. One of the things that we experienced during the Vietnam era was that even our own troops, in some cases, were working against us. And in fact, I told my first sergeant in my company, I said, that I pointed to a fellow and I says, see that guy over there? I said, never ever allow him behind you. Well, if we're shipped out and we go over there, don't ever turn your back on him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew who his father was. And his father was a communist. So, you know, we're fighting communists, right?
Yeah.
And so I wasn't sure how this guy would be. But I just was suspicious enough that, no, let's just keep our eye on them. Don't do anything, just keep our eye on them.
Yeah.
But there were instances in Vietnam and places like that where dissidents would throw grenades into tents and that kind of thing.
Oh,
it was
not
a pretty thing.
Wow. What do you think, Joe? How can we support the troops and be, you know, anti-war, I suppose?
I think you need to support them in a sense where you wouldn't necessarily think, where what the John Birch Society is doing, what the New American does, where we highlight the things and the errors that politicians are making, because a lot of these things that they're doing now aren't even wars. They're just being put in danger in foreign countries, doing peacekeeping missions in you know, a broken down country because, you know, we made a pact with a bunch of other countries. But it wasn't a pact that necessarily benefited us. From what I witnessed, you know, it was us putting ourselves in danger while these people, you know, had no desire for us to be there.
Yeah.
The only ones that were happy were there were the little kids that we give fruit to, you know. Everybody else wanted us gone. They didn't want us in their area. They didn't want our big, you know, tent cities, you know, put up in the middle of their neighborhoods. And, you know, so it's beyond just war. It's just using our military in ways that it doesn't need to be used.
Being somewhere where you're not welcome.
Yeah, we could be a lot more efficient if we kept training as a military to be a military instead of a police, you know, nation, where we go out and we're becoming police officers in other countries and trying to regulate their, you know, their success or decline. You know, that's not really our place.
One of the things that is always propagandized to the American people is that we need to go in and do something here, there, and yon.
Yeah, yeah. That's patriotic to go all over the place.
It'll solve the problems and all that, but it never does. It's perpetual.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been in perpetual war pretty much since the end of World War II because of the United Nations membership. And that's something that the viewers need to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And God bless the guys that have been in uniform and involved in all of this. But you look at the cost that it isn't just over there. Mm-hmm. And it isn't just the cost on human life of our own soldiers. It's the increase in power in the home front.
Yeah.
The increase of this power in the intelligence community and everything else that's now coming forward to show people that, wait a minute, these people have an agenda, and it's not a freedom agenda. It's a control agenda.
Also, perpetual war breaks down the family unit because a parent is gone the whole time. So the traditional roles are out of that family, that military family.
That's right.
You know, so you know, one of the things that I would say to you know, especially you know, all our eras, especially the Iraq and Afghanistan war, because we just got 20 years of that, is, you know, really, you know, remember what you went through, and do you really want to vote in more war for your kids?
Yeah.
Because it was not a pretty war, and no other war is going to be pretty, and it's going to just get worse and worse if we keep, you know, playing around with the Ukraine and the Russian war machines.
Yeah, you think that's going to be the next quagmire they want to send us into? It looks like it, doesn't it?
Well, you've seen the leaks. Yeah. We're already there.
Yeah,
it's not a proxy war anymore.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you guys, like, your service, how have your perceptions changed, you know, versus what they were before you entered the service and even up until now, you know, your service and your perceptions toward military and how it should be used?
I grew up in a military family. My father was in the military. My uncles were in the military. My grandparents were in the military. So, I never had the perception that being in the military was this grand, clean, chivalrous thing. Mm-hmm. I knew it was gonna be dirty. I knew it was gonna be deadly.
Yeah.
So you know, but it's more the experience, not the perception.
Yeah.
The experience that you gain from building those lifelong friendships with people that you served with is the thing that stays with you the longest.
Makes you brothers, huh?
Yep, it absolutely does.
Yeah.
Well, my stepdad was a Guadalcanal veteran in the Marine Corps. So it kind of gives you an idea of how I grew up, you know, hearing about all those battles that he was involved in the South Pacific.
That was brutal stuff, wasn't
it? Oh, absolutely. And he had photographs to prove he was there.
Wow.
They had a photographer attached to his Marine squad. So
Did he show you as a small kid?
Oh, yeah. I won't describe what some of those photographs showed, but they were pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Really brutal.
How have your perceptions changed, Joe? You've kind of hinted at that our conversation.
Well, my dad, he, when we were growing up, he was always, you know, kind of regretted he couldn't join the military because of allergies. Back then, they had strict rules with it. And so my brother joined, I joined, my sister joined.
Yeah.
And when I joined, I thought of it as, you know, this gung-ho adventure, and it was. I loved it. but towards the end, as you mature, you know, and you get older and you start watching what's going on and you see how much money is just wasted. And I mean, it's unbelievable. I had a blast on, you know, America's dime. But it's not a correct thing. No. It's not something that should continue. I would say that the military in general, when I left, was kind of on the road to what you described, where you're just in there, you know, serving with other countries. I know gangs were coming in. They were giving you know, criminals the asset to, you know, join the army or go to prison. They'd join the army, and gangs were starting in the army. I don't know if you experienced any of that over in Afghanistan, but
no. But you know, I see the waste big time. Like, really stepping back and looking. I don't know about your time, but you know, the amount of money that the military complex spends is ridiculous. Like, the army is supposed to be self-sufficient. When was the last time that you drove onto a military base and there was actually a soldier at the gates?
Yeah.
Now, never. It's always a civilian guard that is making twice as much as a military personnel.
The only time I've ever been ashamed of the United States Army was in Frankfurt, Germany. I was over there on and stayed at embassy housing, and a friend of mine had to go down to the PX at the local base. And the soldiers were slovenly. Their uniforms were terrible. It was obvious that there was a lack of discipline and everything else. And this was in the 80s, and about mid-80s. And I just got mad at the general who was in charge for allowing that to take place.
Yeah.
Because another thing that happens, and this is something a lot of people don't think about, we're sending troops to Poland and other places. I witnessed several fights on the streets of Germany between young German men and our servicemen. Because our servicemen are out on the town. They're going to go down to the local
dance hall and the brewery.
Yeah, and make passes at the young girls.
Yeah.
And a lot of those German guys don't like that. And they don't like it in Poland either, or anywhere else.
Well, that's what soldiers do, right?
Well, yeah, sure. Of course, I never did any of that.
No. Except for Art Thompson.
Yeah.
Right.
But anyway. So it creates an animosity between the civilians of a friendly country and our military, which extrapolates into against the feelings against America.
Yeah.
So people don't think about those things either, but those things go on.
Yeah. I got one last question. We're going to finish it up with this. So in honor of those who've fallen for our nation here, what would you like to see change in our nation's military/war policy?
Pull out the UN and NATO and get our military defending our country, not causing issues somewhere else.
There you go.
So. I couldn't answer better than that. get them down on the Texas border.
Yeah.
There's so much they could be doing here instead of in, you know, Japan and subs and, you know, China and Germany. We sell bases in Germany. Why?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a military that... we couldn't control a country that is smaller than Texas.
Yeah.
Why do we have people out of the country? We need to be defending our borders, not somebody else's borders.
That's a great point to leave off on. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Again, thank you for your service. And that's it. We're done for today. Happy Memorial Day, everyone.
Here at The New American, we are excited to cover the World Council on Health's The Better Way Conference in Bath, UK. TNA senior editor Veronica Karolinko will be there reporting live, and she'll be hosting two panel discussions. Please visit betterwayconference.org and get your tickets. The New American magazine has just produced a special report about the future of technology, including artificial intelligence. What will that future look like? Will it be a dystopian nightmare or something far more positive, where technological progress continues to enrich and bless our lives? Three of the contributors to TNA's Future of Tech special report, chemical engineer Jeff Lindsay, TNA publisher Dennis Barrett, and TNA executive senior editor Steve Bonta, joined Gary Benoit for a lively discussion that shed much needed light on these questions. Let's watch.
This is Beyond the Cover with your host, Gary Benoit. And today we have with us three of the authors of our special report on technology in the future. And to my left, we have Dennis Barrett, who is the publisher for the New American Magazine. And we also have Jeff Lindsay, who is chemical engineer. And we have Steve Bonta, who is the executive senior editor for the magazine. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Gary.
Now, Jeff, I'd like to start with you because you wrote the cover story for our special report. And you talked about the future of technology. So very simply, what is that future? Tell us about the good, the bad, and the ugly as you see it.
That's a great question. The future of technology is, well, you can't see the future. You don't know. But there are some very important currents and trends we have to pay attention to. AI right now is one of the hottest topics in the news. I'm seeing all sorts of corporations, from medicine to law to sports, entertainment, art, of course, they're all rushing to take advantage of some of the new tools that have come out with artificial intelligence. And if you're not paying attention to it, it's very similar to what happened when the computer first came out. Well, computers have been around for a long time in various forms, but they became personal when personal computers came out. Everybody could now access it, and that opened up tremendous new opportunities. And some jobs were destroyed by computers. There was a lot of fear when that first became such a big factor. But we found out that computers have helped us become much more productive as a society. We can do all sorts of things easily we couldn't do before. AI is a giant leap beyond what we had with computers alone. AI is taking massive amounts of data and computer software that is able to, in some ways, act human. It's able to parse text. It's able to speak or simulate a lot of human type of thinking, supposedly. And these new tools, ChatGPT, most popular, also Bard by Google, are able to, you can talk with them. You can ask questions like, hey, tell me about chlorophyll. How does that work? Or who was Darwin? What did he do? Or what's happening in this area? What does it mean? And it can summarize things, give you insights, and talk back as if you were talking to a supposedly intelligent person. And I say supposedly, there's some qualifications to that. But this is a new level of technology that enables computer-driven systems to take over all sorts of tasks that makes some people very afraid, to do all sorts of things that couldn't be done in the past. And that brings a lot of opportunities, but also a lot of threats. It is a very powerful computer-aided technology that we really need to understand. So we talk about some of the pros, some of the cons, some of the weaknesses in the article, and there's a lot of stories I love to share, but that's just a quick overview.
Okay. Now, Steve, you did an article where you didn't talk about the pros as well as the cons. You basically focused on the cons, because in your article, you were looking at the surveillance state.
Well, yeah, and that's not a new thing either. I mean, a lot of the technology for mass surveillance and data mining and this sort of thing is not come of age with AI. Although, I mean, the problem is that AI obviously has the potential to amplify the power of these pre-existing technologies manyfold. But, both Jeff and I spent time in the People's Republic of China, and we saw firsthand kind of how that has been deployed to great effect if your goal is to have absolute ascendancy over the actions and even the thoughts of an entire population. In the case of China, a very large population. We saw how just unbelievable banks of surveillance cameras, CCTV cameras, are deployed over the highways. And everywhere you go, it's just like that'd be 50 of them in a big bar across the road every few hundred yards. And many of them will flash very brightly as you drive under them just to let you know that they're watching you. And they're actually being monitored. The police force there has thousands of people who do nothing but stare at computer screens all day, watching pedestrians, watching traffic, watching people buying groceries and so forth and so on. So that's hardly novel technology. On the other hand, Some of the other stuff that's being has been deployed there, used very effectively to cancel people. Jeff was telling me just before we started about a Chinese comedian who was canceled last week for making some comments that apparently were construed as being insulting to the Communist Party and to the People's Liberation Army and so forth. And so he was, as is typically the case, removed from all of his social media, which in China means not only the inability to communicate, but also the inability to travel and to buy and sell and everything else, because it's all accomplished through these all-purpose apps, particularly WeChat, that are used there. So the fear is, well, could this come here? And I think, that is, we sort of tongue-in-cheek called that, tyranny with, or I guess totalitarianism with Chinese characteristics. So here it's going to have a slightly different form, but it's already taking shape. So while our government may be limited, at least in theory, in its ability to collect and act upon mass data to criminalize, pre-crime a la Minority Report or something like that. In practice, what we're seeing in the West is this kind of unholy alliance between the government and compliant major corporations, banks, tech corporations, and so forth, who do the bidding of the FBI, the CIA, and government in general to enforce this increasingly suffocating regime of political correctness and woke ideology. And it's being accomplished. The end is the same, because we all know now what happens if you say something on Facebook or YouTube or anything that is considered too controversial. You can get canceled. You can get kicked off your social media accounts. And there have been cases where people have even, had their credit cards canceled, their bank accounts closed, all this kind of thing. They're still somewhat isolated. It hasn't become systemic yet, but certainly it's being beta tested in places like China, right. And the potential for it coming here is very great indeed.
And of course, it's going in that direction. Mm-hmm. Now, Dennis, in your own piece, you really looked into the future, because you were talking about AI, artificial intelligence, and where that could take us. Worst possible scenario, maybe even the end of man, the end of humanity. But it's not inevitable either. So what are your thoughts regarding that?
Well, it's not inevitable, but one thing that I think I find most interesting about AI is the prospect, whatever it may be, of the achievement of artificial general intelligence, which would be the supercomputer equivalent, if you will, of AI, as opposed to a limited AI that can solve certain problems now or play chess, but an artificial general intelligence which can, with superhuman levels of ability, interact with the world and create new solutions that people themselves cannot come up with, and it's ideally would be much faster than any human mind, would have access to much more information than any other human mind would, and would therefore be quite a bit more powerful in theory than any human or group of humans could be. Now, I wouldn't necessarily be someone who would say that's inevitable, it's going to happen. I actually don't think it may. I think it may not happen. But the real action is going to be in the minds of our technocratic elite leadership internationally, and what do they believe about this? And what actions will they take based on their beliefs? That's where I think the real challenge will come in. So, and I talk about it in Endgame quite a bit in the book that I wrote. Specifically, if you are in that class and you believe there are A, far too many people already, mm-hmm. and B, most of those people will be made completely non-essential because they'll be replaced in their careers 100% by AI, by an artificial general intelligence, now what do you do from a policy point of view? And I think if you project those lines, it doesn't really matter what the actual prospect of AGI would be. What really matters is the belief system of those who may believe it's inevitable and how they might act on that belief system. Mm. And we've seen people act on terrible belief systems historically, just within the 20th century, for instance, and the outcomes were, shall we say, less than ideal. They were quite generally bloody. And I don't think we want to ever see that again, but we're setting ourselves up for a situation where we have a technocratic elite class that seems to believe that there will be too many non-essential people. The soft, fuzzy version of that would be, and you've seen this bandied about, the use of UBI, Universal Basic Income. So people won't be able to have careers any longer. They'll be out of work because of AGI. What do we do with those people? Well, we have to give them a few scraps from the table to let them live. And ultimately, like the World Economic Forum says, you'll own nothing and be happy.
In a 15-minute city.
In a 15-minute city.
5-minute, 3-minute, 2-minute.
Yeah. So the action in my mind is really going to be, what do the technocratic elites do from a policy standpoint based on any beliefs they might have about the relative potential to achieve an artificial general intelligence.
Now, there are transhumanists who believe that this would be a very good thing, because they look upon biology or a biological unit as being fundamentally flawed. For one thing, we all die. From the point of view of God or eternity, they look at AI basically as replacing God, or them becoming gods on earth through AI. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at it that way, where you could become a god on earth, what's to stop such a person from mass murder, from killing just about everybody, getting rid of all these so-called biological units?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of this stems in the first instance from this long-held conceit that we see, this characteristic particularly of Western culture, this metaphor that goes back several centuries, at least to the time of Descartes and so forth, perhaps earlier than that, to the effect that human beings are really a sort of a meat machine. You know, they're all organic beings, culminating in humans, are really completely comparable to and commensurable with the machines that we build, except that they're more complex. And so this is a very, you know, this is an idea that I encountered when I did my graduate work in linguistics, this idea that we're meat machines, and human language and everything else that we produce, you know, art and so forth and so on, are really just sort of a wetware computer program, or the output from a wetware computer program. So this metaphor is a powerful one, and it is what informs a lot of the transhumanists and so forth. The idea is, if we're merely very complex machines, nothing more, then it stands to reason that we, like any other machine, it can be improved by tinkering. It can be modified. It can be harmonized with a machine, with man-made contrivances, you know, a la cyborgs and this kind of thing. Okay. On the other hand, it seems to me that one doesn't even have to you know, have religious faith in the reality of a soul, although that helps, okay? But even aside from that, if you look at, you know, as I did for many years, the phenomenon of human language, there's something about language there, and, you know, we're not going to go into it in depth here, but suffice it me to say that the way humans deploy language, it's not the same as machine language. You know, machine language is this bounded thing. It's binary at its core, whereas human language, and beyond that, all forms of human cognition, are really imminently different in ways that we have yet to fully comprehend. And it's that difference that resides things like spontaneity, creativity, freedom, mm-hmm. love, mm-hmm. and emotions generally, the things that make us human, that will never be replicated, except, I think, in very pallid form, by machines. However sophisticated AI turns out to be, the problem is people who falsely believe that it can be done.
The ChatGPT right now is in a very impressive in many ways. It can really give you the impression you're talking to a human, and a very educated, confident, often arrogant human. And if you don't know what's going on, if you're not paying attention, it can lead you down all sorts of strange pathways, because this tool is really very stupid. It's a language model that knows tons of language and can see your sentences, throw out similar things that seem to match, and make it look like it's telling even a very detailed story. But it is fundamentally dishonest. It is an extremely effective misinformation tool, which I have found in case after case. But when you look carefully at their results, you'll find out many times what they're saying is just garbage. It's word salad. They're great at making this word salad, you know, chop it all up, put it out on the plate, and put some garnishes on it. It looks really great, but you don't know where it came from, or if it's even edible, or if it's toxic. These word salads, they spew out, many people think that these are valid answers, and they are very confident in the answers that they give you. Yes, absolutely, here's the quote, and it will even give you sometimes a page number of reference and give you a quote explaining something. But when you look it up, most of the time, it's just made up. It's truthy, but it's not true. These are wonderful tools of misinformation. And I think right now, even though we don't know how long it's going to take to get something that really could be super intelligent, what we have right now is really quite dumb. It's incompetent, but very arrogant. It's the perfect thing to run an election or to get elected into many mm-hmm. offices in the country. And it's also a great tool for misinformation. So I've noticed both of these tools, Bard and ChatGPT, have these filters that push things toward the ideologies of the left. And if you ask the wrong questions, sometimes you'll even be shut down and criticized for thinking that way. So there are left-leaning tools built in, filters, censorship devices, and the problem is, these are so popular and they're so useful for many things if you find the right sweet spot. They really can be useful. I use them every day now in my work, but you can't trust them. These are going to be used by everybody for lesson plans, for writing their articles as a so-called journalist, for speeches, for it's being used for books, it's being used for publications, it's being used for all sorts of things. It is going to influence thought at a profound level in many, many ways. If we don't understand that and push back or come up with our own tools to do the same with true sources and without the left-leaning filters, we're going to have a great time for the totalitarians and a tough time for the cause of liberty. But we can use these tools for good, and I think we need to be aware of these pros and cons right now. Will it ever get to that level beyond just being a word salad maker? I'm not sure. Right now, I'm not at all impressed that these are ready to take over the world. But they're ready for others to use them to influence us and give us official narratives and misinformation in private public partnerships as the World Economic Forum is pushing for. So they're there. We need to be aware of what they're doing.
And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I agree with Jeff that a very important concern that people have raised about this is where are we on the growth curve of this technology? Are we near the top of it? Is this kind of at the peak? What we're seeing with ChatGPT-4? Are we sort of still at a ground level? And the real modern takeoff point for current artificial intelligence was 2012. There was a real watershed moment in 2012 with the achievement of an image recognition program for AI, and everything has been built from there. So there was pre-2012 AI, which kind of hit what was called an AI winter, and its development was kind of slow. There wasn't a lot of progress. That achievement in 2012 took place, and now we're on a new growth curve, an accelerating growth curve. And I think we're seeing a positive feedback loop in the technology. So from my point of view, I think we're just sort of at the beginning. ChatGPT-4, for me, I think of it in terms of the previous personal computer revolution as a 486DX Intel chip. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's a long time ago, and it was a pretty big technical innovation when it came out. But we look at that now as an antique and slow, bad old days. 10 years from now, 5 years from now, I think we're going to see tremendous growth and innovation in AI, and it's going to be hard for us to predict exactly what it's going to achieve at that point.
We may see innovation. Those winters you talked about, were when the government was funding AI, winter. When the government quit funding, innovation happened. Right now, the strangest thing, the gurus of AI, Sam Altman, the founder of OpenAI, the company that sold $10 billion to Microsoft, that AI, it's got everybody so excited. He's out there telling us, you know, I'm really getting scared of my product. We need the government to step in and help to keep us safe. We need regulation. So when the big would-be monopolists are starting to say, oh, you know, we need some regulation, really tough regulation to save us all, or we're all going to, that's when I really get worried, because the government's going to step in, they're going to start regulating, and then the innovation will be shut down and the authoritarian applications will be ramped up.
Or it'll be channeled, and there'll be a few privileged companies that will be allowed to innovate, and new entrants will be barred, as what you have in the auto industry, for example.
Everywhere government can get, industry can get their hands on government, that's what happens.
It'd be nice from AI, from OpenAI standpoint, for instance, for its up-and-coming competitors to suddenly run into a regulatory roadblock, so they have a nice privileged protected position.
That's it.
And they can maintain that lead through regulation rather than through future innovation.
That seems to be the goal.
Yeah.
So we've talked about obviously the scary stuff, but Dennis and I were having a nice conversation the other day, and I asked Dennis, I said, well, you know, what kind of all of the other next big things in the history of technology have always ultimately owed their growth and acceptance to market-driven things. I mean, sometimes government's there at the start, like with the space race, but the fact is that ultimately it turned out the consumer demand for satellites was what drove space technology, not so much the idea that, well, someday we may put boots on Mars, although maybe now SpaceX is challenging that. But for decades, that's what drove progress in space technology, was the consumer demand for what satellites could give us. And we have GPS and so forth and so on. So my question is, I mean, it almost sounds like ChatGPT started out as sort of a fun little thing, a gizmo, as it were, and it's now being talked about as a way to shape the narrative, all these kind of government-centered things. But what sort of market-driven incentives and interests are likely to to bring out the positive side of this.
There's numerous tailored applications of AI. Right now, dozens of companies are either they're purchasing ChatGPT's tools. They have an API that it's called that they can plug in and start using for their own databases, their own documents. Other people are using AI in different forms. I work with intellectual property, with patents is a big part of my career. And the best tool that's out there is from Japan, wonderful tool that is a patent searching tool. But normal patent searching is very difficult. You have to put in the right keywords, and you're going to get documents that match those keywords, but you might miss the ones that are most relevant. It understands the concept. You can describe the concept. I'm looking for a semiconductor device that can do this. And it can understand that concept and find things that might use completely different language. In fact, often do use different foreign languages. And it comes back with excellent results, better than anything I've seen from other commercial tools. So that's one example of specific problems that can be solved very accurately. For medicine, where you've got to, for pharmaceuticals, where you've got to scan numerous compounds, and now we're getting better predictive computer technologies to predict what a change in a group might do to a drug or a product. AI can be a way to do tons and tons of dirty work with a high level of intelligence, targeted to do the right things and solve real problems.
How about vaccine development?
Vaccine development, too, yes.
I hate to open that can of worms, yes, but, you know, yes. One has to wonder. I mean, that's the problem with vaccines, is that there are so many variables that normally to develop a vaccine with any semblance of reliability takes years, if not decades,
right.
Which is one, and this is not to go off on a tangent, but that's one reason we've been so concerned about the COVID vaccines, is that they were developed so very quickly, and presumably without the aid of infallible AI.
Mm-hmm. Do any of you have any thoughts about the use of AI or the use of technology in general to safeguard our freedoms?
Well, full disclosure, we did use AI in to produce this issue. The cover, I guess, is AI generated.
That's
the cover artwork, and I think we indicate that, so we're not trying to sneak in past people, and we have an entire article dedicated to AI artwork. But
as I walked into the studio, I came past the John Birch Society library with a massive amount of fascinating books that deal with all sorts of issues of history. If we had books like Endgame and the Writings of the Founding Fathers and numerous other books scanned and used to train an AI engine with an understanding of how do we support freedom, how do we recognize corruption, what is good in law, what is bad in law, we could have our own fact checker that could be countering the fact checkers, but give better, not just truthy, but truthful information to counter that. This could be a very effective tool for helping to see through the lies that government tells us, which is why we're going to need regulation to stop those kind of tools.
Now, Jeff, you mentioned Endgame, and I have a copy.
Oh, thank
copy
you.
Of Endgame here, and of course, this is by Dennis Merritt. And Dennis, most of that book paints a very, very dark picture, so to speak.
It's fairly grim.
Very grim, in terms of there being an organized plan. People who are working to use AI and use the technology for world control. And where one of the scenarios could even be the elimination of the human race. And of course, that fits right into the depopulation program that these people have been following for many, many years.
Right.
But at the end of your book, you also offer hope. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, there's two elements of that. First, if we are going to save our constitutional republic from whatever the case may be, it doesn't necessarily mean to be AI, whatever the situation is, we want to embellish, restore, improve our constitutional republic and our adherence to our Constitution. First of all, we all have to be made cognizant, aware, and understand the challenges and threats that we may face, whatever they may be. So most of that book is to describe what some of these specific threats are in light of COVID-19, the pandemic itself, and the response to the pandemic, so people can understand some of those threats, where they come from, the history of them, and where they potentially, if you draw the lines forward, where they might take us. Those things, while grim, do not have to come to pass. And that's the key thing. That's the next step, which is once you're informed, you can take proper action. I talked earlier in another interview about traditional American civic virtue and understanding your role as an American citizen at the local level, but even before that, really local within your family, but at the local level, within your local communities, at your state level, who you ask for representation, how you support that representation. All of those things become much more urgent, and you become much more capable of dealing with them urgently if you're well informed about the challenges coming at them. And you can be a more effective citizen, whether that means just in helping to inform your neighbor so your neighbor understands and starts to put the pieces together, or whether that means you run for office. Typical traditional American virtue within our constitutional republic, as our founding fathers pointed out, is going to be necessary for retaining that constitution and that republic moving forward. Absent that, we don't really have a choice, or a chance for that matter. So,
obviously the AI genie is not going to be put back in the bottle again.
And it does not have to be. It's like most other technologies, Gary. Any technology can be used for good outcomes. And many of those same technologies, in a sense, are dual or multi-use, and in the wrong hands with the wrong motivation can lead to really terrible outcomes. I think AI is just like that with regard to, say, nuclear energy. Nuclear energy, wonderful technology that can power our entire civilization cheaply and safely and in perpetuity almost. AI, just like that, could be a great boon to humanity. Just like nuclear power, on the other side of things, used by tyrants and dictators and megalomaniacs, can be a threat to massive numbers of people. AI used for ill gains could be similarly dangerous. And much of chemistry is the same way. Our technology, generally speaking, is of that nature. So it behooves us as a people to make sure that we're well informed about what the capabilities are, what the good outcomes could be, what the bad outcomes could be, and to help our civilization choose wisely.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. And of course, for people to become well informed, we recommend that you go directly to the special report and read the contents therein, and also go to Dennis Barron's book, Endgame, COVID and the Dark State Quest for Bio-Digital Convergence in a Transhumanist World. And we'll put links in the description for this video so that you'll be able to access those materials. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the New American TV. And don't forget to visit BetterWayConference.org and get tickets to this wonderful event, which is another reminder that freedom lovers around the world are coming together and demanding a better way. We'll see you tomorrow, and don't forget to check out thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news.